Enterprise Management 360, your main source for tech news, analysis, podcasts, and videos for the enterprise.
Hello, and welcome to this EM 360 podcast. My name is Dr. Eric Cole, and I will be your host for today's podcast. I am the founder and CEO of Secure Anchor Consulting, a company that is focused on building out effective security roadmaps that actually work to protect an organization. In today's podcast, I'll be speaking with Andre Priba, CTO at IC Consult Group, and Max Fawn, head of EMEA Consulting at Okta. We're going to be discussing customer identity and access management. Thank you for joining me today, Max and Andre. If you could first let us know a little bit more about yourself before we get started. And Max, let's start with you.
Yeah, hi everyone. My name is Max Fawn. I lead our EMEA consulting practice. Prior to Okta, I worked at Accenture and advised Global 2000 clients across numerous industry groups on strategic decisions. And now I work for Okta, which is a best-of-breed cloud-based identity and access management company that covers B2E, B2B, and B2C use cases.
Hi, everyone. My name is André Priebe. I'm the CTO of IC Consult. I joined IC Consult 17 years ago. And in that period of time, I'm completely focusing on identity and access management because that's our mission as IC Consult, taking care of digital identities, of APIs, and everything around authentication and authorization.
Excellent. Thank you for those intros. And to kick things off, what is identity and access management? And why does it matter to customers?
Yeah, sure, Max here. So, you know, what is identity in a digital sense? I think it's important to recognize that there are four pillars of digital identity that would matter in this, right? So you've got personal or citizen, you've got customer, you've got work, and then you've got IoT or machine. So, you know, my personal or citizen identity uses documents like passports and driving licenses, and that's so I can move freely, I can vote and access healthcare and government services. As a customer, something a little bit different, so a B2C, and that would be, you know, authenticating into websites, could be a bank, could be a retail, a shop, so I can make an e-commerce transaction or purchase something. As a worker, we've got our workplace identity and workplace applications. And then finally, you know, you've got billions and billions of things, such as your doorbell, your TV, or even your fridge that are, you know, communicating with the internet now as part of the Internet of Things. So the point I'm making here is identity is central to making our lives as seamless and simple as possible, both online and offline. Each pillar that I've spoken about is unique, but they have some horizontal threads. And just on that, you know, you can probably imagine I'm going to talk, or we will end up talking a lot today around security, which is paramount. Lots of different ways in which identity interacts with security, and I'm keen to discuss those.
There is one other aspect I would like to add. And that's the reason why do our clients introduce identity and access management for their customers. And one very, very important aspect is that identity access management allows adding new digital touch points and services much faster because the product owners, the developers, they do not have to take care about things like registration, authentication, authorization, social login, and all these kind of things. But they can entirely focus on the core product and core functionality, how they generate value to their customers. And the other aspect is that this new product, what they build, is available to all existing customers of that enterprise without registration, without any additional things to do. It's very easy. It's a complete different starting point than without having an identity and access management in place.
And thank you for that information. I mean, there's a lot of talk about being able to identify devices and what access they have, but why does this really matter to security? And why is this such a common vector that organizations need to focus on?
So Verizon's data breach report, which I'm sure that your listeners are familiar with, you know, it's a yearly study of breaches, said that 81% of all hacking-related breaches were stolen or weak credentials, weak passwords. Just to pause on that for a sec, 81%. So you could think about it in a highly simplistic way and just say 81% of hackers just logged in. I think what you can take away from that is that identity is the primary threat vector. And I think it's interesting, you know, to challenge ourselves and our existing way of thinking and ask ourselves, you know, how much of our budget, how much of our cybersecurity budget did we spend addressing this instead of other, you know, other potentially more interesting ways of getting breached? Possibly none, possibly a little. Some people are aware of the 81% stat, but most people don't know that it's up from 63% the year before. So if you ask me, it's only ever going to increase because they're so easy to do and we're doing so little to stop them. So the point I'm driving towards here is that identity is actually quite a soft target. All a bad actor would have to do is to get some credentials, so usernames and passwords, and you can do that by buying up data troves on the dark web from any one of the weekly mega hacks that we read about in the media. Write a script, password spray, you know, log on as you. I mean, I'm practically talking myself into doing it now, and I play for the defensive team. And you can actually get even more targeted from this. You know, if they have a list of emails, for example, they could impersonate your brand, they could spam those emails with password reset links and steal those credentials. So phishing your customers or business partners there. This is really a primary threat vector, that the most statistically likely threat vector. And I think I just want to add one more thing, which is when we need to think about attacker behavior, not just our own network and our own security, because odds are when an attacker comes along, they didn't come straight to us. You know, they went to our customers, our competitors, other vendors, a supplier. And I think that, you know, in a public cloud future, we need to consider this and take advantage of the network effect of knowledge. You know, we can connect everything together and have an internet scale neighborhood watch. We've actually got a great example of defending against a state level attack against another state where all the critical infrastructure went down, aside from the airport that was using Okta. And we'd seen across our network these attacks going on, and we were able to programmatically and proactively lock it out. So, you know, it raises the interesting point of the benefits of future architectures. And one fun fact on this, for context, this attack I'm referencing was at the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve. So, you know, what were we doing at that point in time? Probably not monitoring our networks, probably on skeleton teams.
Yes, and unfortunately, these data breaches are focusing on the digital identities, and they consist of many PII data. Yeah, so therefore, they are a very critical target. And unfortunately, the protection of this data does not always get the focus it should have. Identity theft and fraud based on that causes a lot of damage to customers affected by that, but also to other enterprises, which are also victims of these kinds of frauds based on these stolen identity data.
Now, Andre, if this is such a big problem, why do you think it's being ignored or not addressed by so many customers?
I would not say ignored, but building digital services, new digital touch points, typically has often a lot of time pressure, because if you are slower than your competitors, yeah, you are losing market shares. So there's a lot of pressure on the product owners, on the developers, to bring up the new services very fast. And security is not getting that amount of attention it should get. And that's the main reason. And that's the reason why this very, very good idea, having an identity access management in place, which is doing not everything for security, but is providing a significant part of that overall responsibility.
Now that we understand the problem set, one of the things that always happens in organizations is sort of this balance between functionality and security. So what can we do to address these security challenges without impacting or ruining the customer's experience?
Well, often there's opinion that security and usability, that this is a kind of trade-off. I have to decide what I want to get. But the good thing is more and more organizations consider passwordless approaches and provide them to the customer, because it provides both better security combined with a better user experience. And there are a lot of examples out there of good push notification-based authentication apps. And also the passwordless standard FIDO2 is winning traction. So by having an identity access management in place, you can leveraging these new technologies to provide both better security and better user experience.
Yeah, so to continue on from this, because I think Andre is hitting the nail on the head here, you know, he's brought up push authentication and passwordless. When you think about friction or things that ruin customer experience. The primary piece that a customer today would notice in a B2C, a CIAM, a B2B, you know, portal, use case, platform, is the MFA itself. And as Andre notes, you know, we probably do need, well, we definitely need the MFA from a security perspective. And I think consumers are becoming okay with that. I get MFA'd on eBay, accessing my Uber invoices on Facebook. You've even got the option to turn it on now via SMS factor only. And I think this is what Andre's driving towards, you know, normal factors, things that you would see today, like one-time passwords or email links, they're pretty slow, they're pretty insecure. Users want frictionless Apple iPhone-like experiences of technology, not pulling out, you know, legacy hard tokens to scribe across rotating numbers or waiting for text factors and bad signals. So with the things that are, with the capabilities that Andre has mentioned, you know, the factor itself can be faster. But that's about the friction of the factor, how to reduce the actual time taken or the ease to respond to a challenge. But what about actually reducing the number of challenges there is? So the challenging can be smarter. I think we've got to think, you know, when we authenticate into a system as a customer or as a business partner, as a vendor, as an employee, you've got a lot of context. Credentials, the usernames and passwords, are just one piece of the context. You've also got third-party behavior. You've got, sorry, past years of behavior. You have third-party intelligence. You know, you can who can hook out to a bot tracking service or an identity proofing service as part of a registration or a logon event. You've got the device. You know, is it known? Is it registered? You've got a physical network. Is it on an office IP? Is it on the same IP that we've seen for the last year because there's been a lockdown and we're in a pandemic? Then you've got geolocation. Most people just throw all of this away and think only about usernames and passwords because, you know, passwords can never be compromised. And all of our usernames aren't firstname.lastname@company or alternatively our email address. So what I'm driving towards here is that smart policies or adaptive policies can use context to decide when and if to challenge a user based on what's going on. And you can remove a lot of the unnecessary prompts that would barely increase security posture for normal users doing mundane things. And, you know, Andre makes a great point. You know, when you think about this context, you can take it a step further and just consider a credential as, you know, just one bit of context, or, you know, most security professionals would say an insecure bit of context, and actually move to a passwordless future that, you know, when you think about B2C flows, absolutely, you know, they're fantastic because when you think about customers, you know, the adaptive piece is far more important here, is you can't always get the customers to use a specific factor you want, you know, a more modern factor, a faster factor. But you can choose to only MFA them as part of a step-up authentication when they're doing something sensitive and it's from a new device and a new IP zone. So there's a really good business case here for keeping customer flow as frictionless as possible because, you know, friction decreases revenue, right? Any kind of friction we put in front of customers causes abandonment. And I think the great example of this is Amazon. You know, Amazon has one-click ordering. It is unbelievably easy to spend money with Amazon, and so they make a lot of money. There's also one more thing. There's a hard cost saving from sending less challenges because those SMS texts you send for MFA challenges, they actually cost you money.
Excellent. Thank you for that information. And Max, if you want to do a case study on how easy it is to spend money on Amazon, my wife could definitely volunteer for that. Yeah, she there's always new boxes coming every day. So
they're good at what they do.
Exactly. So definitely spot on with that. I love that example. But Max, just building on that, what else ruins the customer experience and what can we do to address it?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously I've spoken about MFA, which is a very consciously recognized and intrusive thing that creates friction if done badly. If done well, it really doesn't. But there are a couple of different ways that we create friction for our CIAM users, be they, you know, customers, partners, subcontractors. The first bit of friction I want to drive towards here is actually around identity stores. So I speak to numerous clients who have got multiple brands, or perhaps even, you know, just different apps that a customer interacts with as part of consuming their service. And this is very normal. This is the way the world is moving. But these customers, you know, they have each app. These businesses, they create and they have each app as a standalone entity with its own identity store and its own identity. And, you know, from an IT perspective, that's great because it's very easy to set up. You manage them independently and it creates minimal complexity. And that would seem like a good decision because, you know, it's very, very simple, but actually you realize you're going to have to increase your headcount to manage each incremental offering. So it's only a good decision if your business doesn't grow. So like I was saying, you know, it's a good decision, right? Well, probably not, because from the customer side of things, the customer now has to register and log on to each of these independently. It's horrendous when you're within a session and you're being asked to do multiple logons to different bits of a website. So I'm going to just dream something up right now, and hopefully everyone will have experienced this. Well, not necessarily hopefully, but I think everyone will have experienced this exact thing. So imagine logging on to an airline's website to search for flights, and you search for flights, you log on, that's great. And then you have to log on to a separate portal to search for point or reward flights. Okay, so you're doing that and you realize, oh no, I don't have quite enough points. So then you need to buy some points. You have to log on again to a third bit of the website to buy points to tip us over the edge into having enough. So it's a really bad experience using airline portals because they're not joined up. They're different identity stores, different teams, different bits of the service. Experiences like the one I've just mentioned, you know, they make us quit our session, stop our transactions and go elsewhere. I certainly wouldn't stand for it. I typically rather pay more and order with the aforementioned Amazon one-click ordering than go through the nonsense of an archaic registration form. You know, what I'm driving at here is we should rely on our customers to be as lazy as possible and make it easy for them and play to that. And what can we do? You know, the initial IT decision to have everything separate made sense because with all the technology, that was easy to imagine. But in fact, you know, if we're using newer systems like Okta's Universal Directory, wouldn't it be better if, aside from removing all the customer friction I've just described, you know, we also have a single view of customer journeys and we could upsell and cross-sell using hooks out to marketing systems. So you can automate that entire flow of email campaigns and get a real 360 view. It's really simple. You just drop our agent onto as many directories as you like, and you can read, write, and sync between them, sanitize data, transform data. So that complex problem is solved very easily.
I completely agree. I really want to highlight that aspect, which is very, very important. What is the most important step in communication with the customer? It's a registration, because this is the first time you're going to ask this prospect or customer to give something to you, his data. And typically, it is a very, very good idea to really have data minimization in focus, asking just for the data, which is absolutely requirement at that specific point in time. Later, you can ask him to provide more data, because then he understands that address information is required in order to send something to him, or the birth date, because you have to verify his age, things like that, but not during the registration in the very first beginning. This is especially true for forcing him to generate and enter a new password, because this is the step he wants to prevent. He don't want to have just another password. If you can go for passwordless, great. Otherwise, think about leveraging the identity providers out there trusted by your customer, Google, Apple, instead of having an own password in your systems you have to protect and that you have to take care of, and your customer has to remember. Then another aspect is that we really should prevent showing the customer how our organization is internally structured by different data repositories which are not perfectly synchronized. An identity access management system helps that you can provide really consistent to your customers by having really one set of data, and if he's changing something in one specific digital or physical touch point, this is available in all other touch points. That's something what a customer expects. He's not interested in how you or our organization is structured internally. And what also can ruin the customer experience is, of course, a bad performance, bad response times. If the login pages or also technical things like validating the tokens, if this is something which is not providing a very, very good performance but is adding negative performance impact to the digital touch points, then this is bad for the whole user experience. The last aspect I'm really thinking about when it's about customer experience is ignoring the digital ecosystem the customer has already. And example, if you're going to provide smart speakers and they are able to place and access a library of Apple and maybe Google, but not the Amazon Music. And this is what your customer is using, then that is bad. And this is, of course, all about authentication and authorization, making sure that you have an identity access management system in place, which is able to interact with all these other providers of digital services out there, because this is required to provide really a rich user experience.
Now, when organizations are looking at identity and access management, there's always the buy versus build decision. So can an organization build identity for their customers? And is this something they should do?
Yeah, so we are very often faced with these questions when our customers starting with their journey about digital identities. And if you see the cost to buy a CIM system and compare that to building a custom login page for yourself, then it's really expensive introducing a CIM system. But of course, the login page is just the tip of the iceberg, right? That's what is obvious to everybody. But all the other things, like the registration, the consent management, third-party logins, different flows for registration, but also authentication with multi-factor authentication, all the different protocols out there with multiple flavors. This is something which is not obvious at the beginning because it's not necessary to have it at the beginning. Yeah? But the requirements, when it is about digital identities inside the organization, these requirements will grow in a very short period of time. And by building up an own CIM system, which will likely have a lifetime of 10 years or more, this will result in 2 points. One is it will get more and more expensive over time because the maintenance efforts will grow over time because you have to add new functionality all the time. And this will result lead to the second point, this is that you will have a lack of flexibility. Each change is time-consuming and costs a lot of resources. And even if you try very hard, you will not be able to keep up with competitive offerings out there. So this is really what happens when building a CIM system on yourself. So I really can recommend looking out into the market for the available CIM systems like what is Okta providing. Look at all these features and try to think not what do you need today to provide a minimum viable product to your customers, but what will you need in 1 year, in 5 years, because that's what you have to have in mind. And don't forget about this digital ecosystem I mentioned before. So the journey is at the beginning very easy, but it's going to get more and more complex in a very, very short period of time.
Yeah, and to add to this, fully agree. Building identity, as Andre says, if you do it in-house, it's a complex and time-consuming task. And if done incorrectly, you're actually going to trigger a number of security vulnerabilities. Many organizations struggle to scale their apps and bring them to market at a competitive pace. And I think, to take a customer angle, customers don't care why you're slow to fix something or to launch a new service. They just care that they can't do something that they want to do. And in this competitive landscape that Andre brought up, with other vendors or with other competitors, breaches and data misuse cases are frequent news items. Customers are losing confidence in digital experiences and companies selling their data. So if you have something, let's say a single app, and there's users hitting it and nothing else is going on, so perhaps what he was referring to with the minimum viable solution, the minimal viable product, as long as you build enough resiliency and high availability, you can do this. But it's an incredibly basic use case, and it rarely happens in today's world. It definitely isn't going to happen in 1 or 2 years' time. So the point I'm getting at is you have to think of your developers, the people that build this stuff for you, as an expensive resource. And it's an incredibly competitive labor market. Devs are hot jobs, and they change companies more quickly than other careers. Most don't even know how many people they have running their existing solution. But when you think about advancing and increasing the features and the use cases you want to support, you're likely going to increase the amount required just to keep the lights on, let alone the build effort of these things. And the implications of not just supporting more features or being more resilient in today's world, but what about, you know, organic customer growth over time? Potentially, you're going to have to recruit contractors or even worse, a consultancy to actually help you keep up. So, you know, your identity service, it protects and manages the most critical applications and data. And in some cases, we're actually talking about your revenue from these customer-facing portals. You know, it really is the keys to the kingdom here. And you've got to, you know, be it build or be it buy, you've got to be evaluating based on architecture, feature set, not just for today, but as Andre mentions, for tomorrow as well. And, you know, availability, security, and scalability. You know, the service has to be always on and architected for extreme resilience with zero downtime and zero maintenance windows, because it doesn't matter how cool your product is or how cool the features you offer are. If they're not available, then it doesn't matter. And, you know, I'm sure that we have all dealt with a major, major, major provider over the last, let's say, 6 months, but even 2 weeks ago, you know, dealing with worldwide outages. So this stuff is not easy to do. And the security, you know, it's got to be world class. It's got to have innovative security controls and features. It's got to be built with zero trust security posture. And as an example of this right now, I'd advise going to the recent social media hack and reading about that as kind of an example of what not to do. So, you know, the service, and finally, the service, it's got to be scalable, but that can't have manual intervention. If you're doing a global product launch, or perhaps you're, you know, people are buying airline tickets after a lockdown or a pandemic rule is eased, or maybe you're a broadcaster and you've got a broadcast that's going out. You know, you can't be manually scaling up and scaling down to meet business needs. It's too slow. But on the subject of scalability, if we're being honest, there's something I've learned from my years in IT and consulting. It's that you're not going to get anywhere near as much budget as you want to do this. And you never get the budget you want to do the things you need to do. You make do, but you still get blamed when it's going wrong. So buying it typically is a easier approach, assuming they're backed up by SLAs.
Excellent. As we start to wrap up, and we're getting a little tight on time, so we'll try to keep this next question as brief as possible. But can you each provide just a quick case study with one of your customers of how you helped solve this problem?
I can liven it up with a real example, but I want to briefly speak about perhaps the other side, a war story of getting it wrong. You know, if you want to read about customer success stories, Google Okta and then things like Adobe, Allergan, LinkedIn, MGM Resorts, or Western Union. But I want to just circle back to the defense of I didn't have enough budget and how that's not really good enough anymore. So imagine, this is real, by the way. So a bricks and mortar and digital retailer, High Street, in the UK, they were talking to myself, in, you know, sort of a 6 month procurement cycle, so quite slow. And Black Friday came round within this cycle. And essentially, they had told us that Black Friday was the only point in the year where they break even from the digital, from the e-commerce sales. So it went down on Black Friday. I didn't have much sympathy since they had spent a lot of time talking to us, but the CEO chewed out the CIO and locked down the IT budget until it was fixed. The irony, of course, is that they were trying to buy a solution to this problem. The reason it happened was probably due to starvation of budget and legacy technology in the first place. So the simple fact remains, if they only break even on Black Friday, then keeping your service up is pretty much the entire reason the IT team exists, which they failed at. Now, fast forward 1 year into the pandemic, and as we're very aware, you know, IT e-commerce sales have risen massively. The company still hadn't executed or still hadn't basically agreed anything with us. And so another Black Friday comes around and their service goes out again. And next day they file for bankruptcy. So what I'm driving at is downtime is very significant in a B2C context. The best case of an outage is that your brand suffers reputational damage from delivering a bad service. The worst case is revenue loss. And to make this real, you know, there are 438,000 minutes in a month. So a 99.9% uptime or SLA means 44 minutes of downtime contractually in a month, which is a lot. 99.99 means 4 minutes. That's 10 times less outages, and that's contractually speaking. So this is the level that Okta is offering contractually, 99.99. But with all these things, that's just our contracts. Our achieved uptime in 2019 was 99.99995 across our service.
Yeah, after Max presented a very good example of what happens without having a CIM, in place. I want to share a story of a customer who decided to introduce it. First, they thought there's no demand for it. They have the e-commerce platform able to deal with digital identities as well, and that's fine. They do not need more than that. But the client is building and providing household appliances, and later they, of course, moved into the area of connected devices. And then was a point in time when they really understood that they have to have a consumer identity access management in place, because to enable these connected appliances to not just provide information about supplements to these products, but to allow the user to order them with one touch in the app. And that's what is there today. But it is clear that in the near future, these household appliances, for example, dishwashers, will order the required supplements by themselves on behalf of the customer, so that overall experience for the customer is getting better, that making the customer's life easier, because that's a goal of what each CRM system, of course, should provide.
Thank you, Andre and Max, for all your great insight on today's topics. And thank you to everyone who listened to our conversation. If you would like more information on what we've discussed today, make sure you head over to ic-consult.com and okta.com.